Before we begin this week's episode in celebration of Pride Month, we want to do what we can to amplify the voices of community partners who are making DC better. Each episode, we'll be sharing an organization that we support and hope you will too. When Ruby Corrado fled the Civil War in El Salvador more than 30 years ago, she arrived in DC as a transgender teen and found no support system. In 2012, Ruby and friends changed that after tirelessly organizing and building community. Casa Ruby is the only LGBTQ, bilingual, and multicultural organization in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area that provides social services and programs catered to the most vulnerable in the city and surrounding area. Casa Ruby is everyone's home, not just LGBTQ populations, but also their families and the larger community. You can support their mission by learning more and making a tax-deductible donation at www.casaruby.org. That's www.casaruby.org and following them on social media at CasaRubyDC.
Everybody, I'm Rebecca.
And I'm Becca.
And we are Tour Guide Tell All. We are back with you for another episode tonight. Becca, do you want to introduce us?
Sure. So welcome to Tour Guide Tell All. That's our podcast where we lovely tour guides tell you a little bit about our history, local, national, international history. We've chosen for our topic today for this week to talk a little bit about Pride and talk about gay history, particularly in Washington, D.C., but I think as it influences sort of the greater movement across the United States. So this podcast will air. It'll post in the month of June, which is Pride Month. The reason that we have Pride in June is because it commemorates the Stonewall Riots, which are sort of marked as sort of this turning point in the movement. So June 1969 is when the Stonewall Riots take place. So across the country, many municipalities have chosen June for their Pride. Unfortunately, here in Washington, D.C., sort of out of deference for the coronavirus and public safety and health, because Pride in D.C. is a huge event that brings thousands and thousands of people to town. They are postponing our Pride celebrations, and we don't know at the time of this recording when they're going to postpone them to, but if we find that information out, we'll be sure to put it with the show notes when we post this podcast. So I'm really, really excited about this topic. I know you and I, Rebecca, have talked a lot recently about learning more about the sort of LGBTQ history in Washington, D.C., talking more about these figures, integrating this more into our tours. So I'm really excited for today's topic.
Yes, I am really excited as well. This topic has been kind of interest to me. I have read a lot about queer history, and most of the time when you read about queer history, it's sort of Stonewall is the beginning of sort of notable queer history. And so it was interesting to me, a lot of this podcast is going to be back before Stonewall. So it'll be sort of a little bit of pre-Stonewall history. And it ties in with DC. There's a bunch of really important activists, and this is a really great story. It really interesting to me that I've been really excited to talk about.
I think just in the research, sort of looking at all the great research you did for this episode, I think this really overlaps into some other areas that I know we're both passionate about, but talking about the women's movement, talking about the civil rights movement. I think it hits on some of the things that can be unique about living in Washington, D.C., that weird overlap of the federal government and your private life, and sort of being the epicenter often of these what may seem tedious but important changes in our lives. So I think this is going to be a really cool topic, and I'm so excited about all the work you put into this.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this too. This is going to be fun, and there's a lot of room sort of to do other episodes post-Stonewall, the AIDS crisis. That all is going to happen later. And so that's something we can do episodes about a little bit later, along with some of the names we're going to mention. We can do full episodes on them a little later. But we're going to start with something called the lavender scare. And if that is immediately conjuring up an image for you of the red scare, you're exactly where we want you to be. The red scare, and I'll go into just a very brief bit of detail about it. The red scare, you're thinking Joseph McCarthy, you're thinking communists, you're thinking, you know, that very famous clip of communists are infiltrating the State Department, which is all happening at the same time. The other set of people that McCarthy is going to go after are going to be homosexuals. And it's called the lavender scare because the colors and the lavender and, you know, McCarthy and all that. So
I believe it was actually Senator Dirksen who was often quoted in the press using that, which I have to, I don't know if I would say laugh, but when I see that name Dirksen on the Dirksen building, it sort of gives you that twinge of this. I think obviously we think of McCarthy with the lavender scare, but, or with the red scare, but that Dirksen was sort of the one constantly putting that out into the press.
Mm-hmm. Someday we should talk about all of the Senate and House office buildings and how they're named for weirdos. But anyway, that's a digression. So to back up, even before this, World War II is in a lot of ways the sort of expansion of Washington, D.C. There's a lot of people from all across the country that move to Washington to get involved in the war effort. And it also becomes a pretty open place for gays and lesbians. And so World War II in the 40s, Washington's not really accepting of the gay culture the way that they, absolutely not the way they are today, but it's sort of a more open society. Then of course, when you get to the 50s, there's going to be this immediate and very violent backlash against the sort of permissive nature of gay movement. And so you get a lot of people who are very offended and upset that the sort of gay culture is sort of permeating Washington. And McCarthy sort of takes advantage of that. He is going to call homosexuals subversives. And he talks about how they're easy to entrap and bribe and blackmail. And so therefore they're a danger to national security. And he also talks about how gays are communists. And so he links the homosexual movement with the fear of communism, which is terrible, but for McCarthy's purposes is like public relations gold. And he makes crazy headlines, and he promotes sort of silently. There's a lot of people around him that promote the idea that there's, you know, this gay cabal that's going to take over the world, and it's this really fear-mongering sort of terrible stuff.
Is this the first time we hear people talking about the gay agenda?
Yeah, the gay agenda. They have a name for it actually back then. They call it the Hominturn, which is like the Comintern, which is it does exist. The Comintern is a communist international. They're trying to, you know, promote communism across the world. And so this is the Hominturn.
I just say it's very convenient that, particularly in this time, if there was anything that sort of upset the delicate balance of power, it was obviously communism. So people who are gay, that's communism. Women who want equal rights, that's communism. People who are fighting against segregation, that's communism. Very convenient.
It is very convenient. And it is... communism becomes one of those terms that's used exactly right, like kind of like socialism is today. Anything we don't like is communist. And it really is difficult to overstate just how afraid people were of communists. And there's a real legitimate fear of communists taking over the government, that the Soviet Union is invading. And McCarthy sort of very smartly and very adroitly connects that to people's kind of distaste for homosexuals and really kind of runs with it to the point where President Eisenhower, not too long into his first term in 1953, he's going to sign Executive Order 10450, which is going to effectively ban all homosexuals from the federal workforce. It's going to out them, and then basically they all get fired. So if you're found to be homosexual, you're out. They're going to fire you. You don't have a recourse. There's nothing you can do. And it's this very draconian, very terrible executive order that's going to result in over 5,000 federal employees losing their job. And just as an aside, like 5,000 people is a lot of people to be unemployed. And it's a lot of people that like suddenly you're just going to force competent people who are trying to help the government fight communism. You're going to just force them out. So it really becomes this very terrible and kind of draconian order that Eisenhower puts out. And it remains on the books for decades.
I find it, you know, you hear these sort of executive order, you hear that people lost their jobs, but the situations of this are really terrible. I'll use the example of William Dew, who I was reading about kind of in preparation for this episode, 1958. He's an African-American air traffic controller. He's married with three kids, and he is questioned, and he openly confesses that he did have some same-sex relationships as a college student. So when he's questioned about it, he doesn't lie. He's not currently at the time of this investigation pursuing it. He has a pretty much perfect employment record, and yet they fire him simply for the fact that at one point in his life, he had these same-sex relationships. He fights this. He fights it for a six-year legal battle, which certainly couldn't have been easy at this time. It finally goes to court in 1964. It's up for consideration by the Supreme Court. They decide they're going to hear this case. And so the Civil Service Commission, which was sort of the body that was often used at this time, I think, determine who was going to work for the federal government. They basically decided, you know what? We don't want this case to go before the Supreme Court, because what if the court rules in his favor, then we'd actually have to have federal protections for these employees, or we might not be able to carry out these firings as easily. So they basically say, okay, you get 6 years of back pay, and we're just going to withdraw the case. So I think William Dew is a good example of the kinds of people that were losing their jobs and these situations. And many people didn't have the time, energy, or money to fight for 6 years in a long, drawn-out legal battle.
Yes, absolutely true. And one quote that I read was about the Lavender Scare was that few events indicate how psychologically racked America was becoming in the 1950s than the presumed overlap of the communist and the homosexual menace. So it's this really overlap and people kind of go a little bit crazy and a lot of people lose their jobs. Another one person who loses his job who really sort of jumpstarts the gay rights movement in Washington is a man named Frank Kameny. Frank Kameny was an astronomer and he gets fired from his job. And he says later that his government had declared war on him. And so he declares war on his government. And so he goes
I have to jump in here. I'm so sorry, because the situation that gets him fired is so outrageous to me. I don't know if you were going to mention this, but I think it just goes to show the insidious nature of what was happening in this time. He is in San Francisco. He's in a men's room at a bus terminal. He is approached by a man at a urinal. He rebuffs the advance. And as he's exiting, undercover San Francisco police officers arrest him. He has committed no crime. He did not engage in any sexual activity, which even then, if he had, right, it's insane that that would have been a crime at that time. But he literally, by the books of the law, had done nothing wrong other than simply being gay. And this is what gets him fired from his government job. It's entrapment. It's a stretch of the law to carry out a political agenda. And it's no surprise that it's kind of what motivates him, why he decides to kind of go to war with the federal government, because I think if that happened to any logical person, you would feel that your civil rights were being violated.
Absolutely. And he does. He really devotes himself to activism. He gets first he tries to get his job back. He gets a lawyer and the suit goes through the courts and eventually he loses and he wants to appeal to the Supreme Court. And his lawyer's like, look, you don't have any chance. I'm working in contingency. I'm out. Like, I'm not pursuing this for you. And so Frank Kameny, who does not have a law background, he petitions the Supreme Court pro se, which means he does this on his own. Like, he writes his own petition. He does his own research to petition on his own. Like, you can imagine, like, trying to get the Supreme Court to hear your case without the benefit of a lawyer. They do not grant him cert. They don't hear his case. And so that's kind of the end of his suit for his reinstatement. And he goes on to really devote the rest of his life to gay activism. He helps to found the Mattachine Society, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. And he also organizes the first LGBTQ protest in front of the White House in 1965. When he does this, he's kind of very smart about it. He insists that all the protesters dress appropriately. He says, we've all been fired from our jobs. We want another one. Dress like you want a job. So slacks, button-down shirts for the men, you know, nice dresses for the ladies, nice hair. He coordinates, they all coordinate their signs. And he wants this to be, and this is something that he's taking directly from the civil rights movement, the idea that don't give people a reason to discredit you. Look appropriate, act appropriate. We're trying to stage a protest. We're not trying to get violent or get on the news. We're trying to get, you know, our message is going to be blurred if it's about us. And so he really kind of exemplifies the beginning of that movement. The other person that really helps with these protests, and I want to mention her really briefly, her name is Ernestine Eckstein. And that's a pseudonym. She sort of is active under her first name is Ernestine, but her last name is different. And Ernestine Eckstein is a civil service employee. Like, she has a government job. They have not figured out that she's a lesbian, but she's also an African-American woman. So we got three strikes against her, and literally every incentive in the book to keep her mouth shut and keep her government job. And she says, nope, not going to do it. She goes in front of the White House and protests as well. And she protests, like, again, she does her very best to sort of blur her identity. She appears in a magazine photograph sort of with her face obscured, so you can't quite identify her. She goes by an assumed name. And that's about all we know about her. She's active in the movement. She's for a brief amount of time, but in order to try to keep her government job, she tries to maintain as much anonymity as she could. And this is the sort of really systemic fear that a lot of gay activists are going to be up against in the 1960s as we're sort of moving through the civil rights era. So they are sort of very much in tandem with the African-American civil rights movement, the women's movement. These are all kind of coalescing kind of at the same time.
And you can understand, I think, why they're so hesitant, some people, to hide their identity, to use assumed names. Part of what the executive order did was enable different government agencies to carry out these purges of their employee roles. And so they did things like deputize the United States Postal Service to read people's mail, to look at what publications were arriving. And they would use even the sheer presence of a certain publication being delivered to an employee's house as evidence of this so-called deviant activity. So when you have to worry about whether your mail carrier is checking to see what might be coming to your home, you can see why some people would be very hesitant to be photographed in a magazine or talk to a reporter, let alone be the face of a movement, which is why I think what Frank Kameny does is so incredible, because it wasn't without risk, not just the risk of never being able to hold a federal job again, but certainly a lot of great personal risk to himself as well.
Yes. And Frank Kameny is, I listened to a recording of him on the Making Gay History podcast. The man who runs the podcast had interviewed Frank Kameny, I think in the 90s, and he was a pistol man. That's what my mother would have called him, a pistol. He continues this the rest of his life. He works to remove homosexuality as a diagnosis in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is sort of the Bible for psychiatrists and psychoanalysts. He, up until that time, being homosexual was a diagnosable condition. It was a mental disorder, and Frank Kameny sort of spearheads the effort to say, no, it's really not, and get it removed as a diagnostic condition. He is the first openly gay candidate for Congress in 1971. He runs in Washington, D.C., where we actually don't have a voting member of Congress still. He does not win, but his campaign sort of morphs into the Gay Activist Alliance, which is later the Gay and Lesbian Activist Alliance, which is a major, to this day, LGBTQ lobbying group in Washington. And he also gets, in 1973, he sort of spearheads the D.C. Council passes Title 34, which includes sexual orientation among protected class. Washington, D.C. is the first U.S., major U.S. city to have such a law.
I feel like when we talk about queer history, so often the focus is sort of New York and San Francisco, understandably, but I think that Washington, D.C., because of all that was happening in the city in the late 60s, early 1970s, the push for home rule, right? The push to have the council, the push here of all these movements coalescing, coming to D.C., the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the LGBTQ movement, it sort of put D.C. kind of at the forefront. And so when we actually look at legislation being passed in the city. DC often was ahead of the curve, sometimes, like in the case of Title 34, ahead of San Francisco and New York. So little DC pride in here, but we really were, I think, just as significant in trying to set a tone for the rest of the country when it came to protecting sexual orientation in law, even ahead of the federal government.
Absolutely. And I feel like DC doesn't get enough credit for that. Like San Francisco and New York are like the sort of big gay capitals, particularly San Francisco. And a lot of people have heard of Harvey Milk. And if you haven't, there's a great movie about that. And, you know, San Francisco rightly is considered sort of the gay mecca, but DC is also kind of, along with a lot of other civil rights platforms, DC is kind of on the forefront with LGBTQ movement as well, which is really, well, hometown proud of that. Tammany is also going to found sort of something called the Mattachine Society. The Mattachine Society, Tammany introduces it to DC, but it had existed for more than a decade in a couple other cities. It starts in LA, in all major US cities, Chicago, San Francisco, and New York. The name, I was pretty curious about the name because it's kind of unusual. Mattachine was a society in medieval France for unmarried men. And so somebody along the founding of the society decides to sort of look back into history and finds this medieval French society called the Mattachines, and they reintroduce it sort of in a modern context in the United States. Frank Kameny starts this in DC in 1961, and he starts out with about 20 members. So pretty small initially, and a few of them are going to be women, but they grow in size, and the Mattachine's heyday in Washington is going to be sort of the 60s, right up until Stonewall, but they're going to picket the United Nations in New York. They picket the Pentagon, Independence Hall in Philadelphia. They have what are called Reminder Day protests, which are they're on July 4th, and they're designed to remind Americans that LGBTQ people do not enjoy basic civil liberties in this country. So those Reminder Day protests are going to go along for years. And that is part of what sort of morphs into the gay pride parades and protests. The Reminder Day protests are going to be July 4th. Stonewall happens at the end of June in 1969. And the next year, 1970, there's going to be a Reminder Day protest. They link it up with Stonewall. And that's where pride has been, why it's been in June ever since. The major campaigns of the Mattachine Society include they fight for security clearances. Homosexuals have been denied security clearance. They are considered to be a security risk. For military service, federal employment protection, decriminalizing certain sex acts, and they fight against entrapment by the police. So what happened to Frank Kameny can't happen to other people. The police aren't allowed to sort of entrap you. They also
specifically about entrapment actions in DC. One thing I found interesting as we were sort of digging in is that for a long time, kind of early 1900s up to about the 1950s, the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, DC certainly made arrests for sexual perversions and sort of these criminal sex acts, but very rarely did these result in anything but a fine. And the fine had been $25. That was established back in 1802. It's because of the influence of the federal government, particularly this subcommittee that commissions a report, sometimes called as the Crittenden Report or the Huey Report. They put pressure on the MPD here in Washington, D.C., because some of these people who are being fined were probably federal employees. That's their argument. That's why they decide they should have influence over MPD policy. So they're going to push D.C. police to raise the fine to $500 or a six-month jail sentence. So up to about the 1960s, if you had been caught by the police, you might have walked away with a small fine, maybe not the worst thing that could happen. All of a sudden, because of this Lavender Scare, you could be hit with a major fine or find yourself facing jail time. And then you would know that the MPD, if you were a federal employee, would turn that information over to the United States Civil Service Commission, which would very likely fire you from your job. So all of a sudden, there's a financial motivation for the police that didn't exist before because the fines were much bigger, and they're getting pressure from the federal government to do this entrapment. So when we're talking about DC in particular, you really start to see how kind of that pressure from the federal government starts to grind down on a local level in a way that may not not have existed in the same way in other cities. But I think some of these more aggressive members of Congress saw the opportunity to root out this homosexuality in the federal government by doing it on a local municipal city policing level.
They also, 1968, Frank Kameny helps coin the term gay is good, which is really great. It's taken obviously from Black is Beautiful. So 1968, again, this is the year of the all kinds of different civil rights protests. And the LGBTQ movement is sort of at the beginning of activism, but still very much present in the alongside the civil rights movement, the women's movement. So you kind of see the connection there. Do you want to talk about Eva Freund?
Yeah. So it's, I think, hard with the topic like this because there's so many interesting people and she probably deserves her own episode. But one of the very few female members initially, so when the Mattachine Society is founded, it's primarily white gay men. There's a few men of color. There's a few women, but it's very, very limited in its early years. But Eva Freund was one of them. She was spurred into getting involved because of a police raid. So these are the situations that LGBTQ people were facing in this time. She was at a lesbian bar in the early 1960s. The police show up and just start asking for IDs without cause, without reason. Most people are just handing over their IDs because they don't want any trouble. And she refuses. She says, "You have no cause to ask for my ID," and she's pretty sure she's about to get her head bashed in, and they end up walking away and leaving her alone, and she realizes that if people fight back, there could be some change, maybe, if they could push back against these policies. So she is actually neighbor. She lives in the same neighborhood as Frank Kameny, and that's how she gets introduced to him, but she gets quite involved with the Mattachine Society. She's going to, however, find it kind of difficult because she feels like, as a woman, they don't always value her input. And she feels like sometimes some of the male members of this group thought of her as kind of like a secretary, that she was just there to fetch coffee and take notes. She took umbrage at the dress code for protests because she preferred personally to wear pants. And Frank Kameny was always telling the women at these protests they had to wear dresses and heels and pearls. And she just felt like that was not her style. She eventually says she leaves the Mattachine Society because she just felt that ultimately, if she had to look at her sexuality and her gender, she felt that her gender took precedence, which I think is such a tough situation for anybody to have to decide what part of them is more important. But she would go and join the DC chapter of the National Organization of Women. And not too surprisingly, she was the first open lesbian to be a member of that group. So she starts to bring kind of that queer mentality over to the women's movement. We start to see some of this overlap that's going to happen in Washington, DC as we move into the 70s, where these movements are starting to converge and overlap and gel together. But she was, yeah, one of the first female members of the Mattachine Society.
We should definitely do a full episode on her. She sounds fun.
She did a great, we'll link to it in the show notes. She did a really great in-depth interview with the Washington Post in 2019, talking about her experience as a federal government employee, being involved in these movements, but keeping it very quiet at work. She was out being an activist. She was out, you know, going to these bars and living this life. But day to day in her office, she kept that truth about herself a secret to keep her job. So she's a very interesting woman.
Sounds out. The other really important LGBTQ society that's worth mentioning in sort of the pre-Stonewall years is the Daughters of Bilitis. They are going to be based in San Francisco. They're spearheaded by two really fascinating women, Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, one of which, by the way, just passed away like a month ago. Yeah, Phyllis Lyon. I remember when I was living out west, they founded this society in the 50s. They have been partners since the 50s. They're the first couple to get married when San Francisco allowed it. And Phyllis Lyon just died at like 96, like a month ago. Amazing. And they were very similar to the Mattachine Society. They're going to be fighting for what were called at the time homophile rights and the sort of fighting for LGBTQ recognition in Washington and sort of elsewhere around the country. Oh, I want to talk about the DuPont Circle blackmailer, Becca. I want to hear you talk about this.
So I think what was interesting for me sort of looking at this was looking at what this was like beyond, I think, just the actions of the federal government and how much the actions of the federal government influenced local politics and local policing. Because as you were saying kind of at the top of the episode, Washington, D.C. was a pretty safe place to be gay in that kind of part of the earlier part of the 20th century. We were kind of a cosmopolitan, sophisticated city. Around DuPont Circle in particular, a really large gay community grows up, lots of businesses and support, and people feel safe. And that really attitude really starts to shift into the 1950s, 1960s, and even into the 1970s. So even as this movement is gaining traction, as it's becoming more vocal, there is still a lot of fear. And there was a man who was dubbed in the local press the DuPont Circle blackmailer. He would basically sit in his car outside of bars. He'd watch men come and go. He would track their license plate numbers. He would track the make and model of their car. He would write down descriptions of what they look like. Sometimes he would follow them and see which establishments they went to over the course of a night or a day or an afternoon. And then he would basically blackmail them. He would send letters demanding payment. And he would say that if they didn't pay him, he would go to the police, or he threatened to go to the federal government. So this was pretty creepy stuff. He did it for about a year and a half. He was being tracked by what today, if you were to pick up the paper, is called the Washington Blade. Back then it was called the Gay Blade. And the Gay Blade would keep track when people were blackmailed. They would usually write to the Gay Blade to warn people. And you could actually pick up a copy of the Washington Blade in the 1970s. And there would be information on how to handle being blackmailed, who were lawyers you could trust, who in the gay community might be able to help you, who would give you a loan if you needed it. He starts out relatively small, asking $100, $200, but he gets so emboldened because people are willing to pay to keep this information private, he starts charging $1,000 in these blackmail letters. He's eventually caught in July of 1971. He was like a 40-year-old suburbanite from Maryland, just a suburban dude out to make some cash. And he is going to be tried and jailed for entrapment and blackmailing. But at the time that he was picked up by the police, he was going to his Dropbox and picking up three envelopes, each with $1,000 in them. So this was a man who was collecting, they believe, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in blackmail in just a year and a half. And it's terrible, but I think it also illustrates, even as this activism is starting, even as these movements are gaining ground, you could still be fired from your job. Period. You could still lose your benefits. You could lose your financial security, and not just if you worked for the federal government, because these employment laws often applied to private employers in DC as well. And there was pressure from the federal government on private companies to follow suit. And so even as you have this great movement of wanting recognition, of wanting rights, of wanting to be yourself, gay is good, you still could lose your job. You could lose your home. You could lose your mortgage. These were very real fears. And so the DuPont Circle blackmailer, I think, is a good illustration of sort of what's happening at this time, all the progress that's being made, but the fear that so many people were still living in.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And this is going to lead up to we're kind of leading up to Stonewall, which is a huge, it still is a bar in New York City that gets raided by the police. And in June of 1969, and it's sort of the very beginning, it's a very good entry point for anybody who's interested in sort of learning more about queer history. Stonewall is kind of the beginning of what is considered to be gay activism. And one of the sources I read said that, you know, queer history is basically Stonewall, the 70s are a lot of good times, and then the AIDS in the 80s. But I feel like, you know, one of the things that, and hopefully we'll talk about this in a later episode, is that when the AIDS crisis begins, a lot of gay and lesbian activists are really reluctant to sort of have the government deal with this, because they've fought so hard for all of these rights. And so they're really sort of, they're just coming out of the closet. They're just being accepted sort of by straight society. And they're really reluctant to give up all the gains that they have made through the Mattachines, through the 1968, all the way through the 1970s. So it's really going to be kind of adds an extra shading to queer history as you're kind of moving into the 70s. The executive order, it's worth mentioning that Eisenhower signs in 1953, is not repealed until 1995. President Clinton repeals it 42 years later, like, right, I have that math right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
We're historians. Math is not our strong suit. But yeah, President Clinton repeals it. And what he does is he's going to morph this executive order. It's going to become something that we probably all heard of called Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which was just repealed a few years ago by President Obama. So the executive order is sort of leading. We're still seeing the after effects of this right up until about a decade ago, from the executive order firing all homosexual employees from the federal government to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which is going to affect the military, right up through that repeal just a few years ago. So it's really a great example of sort of where all of these movements are coming from, and how far we've come, and how far the queer community has come. So it's a, I think, really kind of interesting backstory to all of that.
Yeah, I mean, between the managing society and Clinton sort of repealing this executive order, you have, you know, like you said, like 40 years, right, of activism and fighting. Yes. Three mass marches, three big major protests in Washington, D.C. have to take place in order for this to happen. We're talking about the work of countless hundreds of thousands of people on their local and state levels to push for this. It's a really, really hard fight, and it's sadly one that's not over, particularly when it comes to keeping these sort of legal protections in place.
And by the way, in case you're wondering, Frank Kameny was actually at the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell when Obama repealed it in 2010. It was like about a year and a half before his death in 2011, but Frank Kameny was actually there.
That's amazing. I didn't realize that. That's so cool.
Yeah, it really is kind of cool. There actually is, in D.C. to this day, Frank Kameny Way on 17th Street between P and R, which is the heart of the DuPont Circle area. They have part of that block, that whole block is named for Frank Kameny. And if you're not familiar with Washington, D.C., you should come. The DuPont Circle area has been for decades the sort of epicenter of LGBTQ life. There are other places in the city, but DuPont is really sort of the epicenter. That's where Pride is. It's where all sorts of the gay activism is going to happen, right in the DuPont Circle area. So it's really the epicenter of the gayborhood, as the kids say. And the Mattachine Society does still exist. It's worth mentioning.
Yeah, it exists today in a sort of different iteration. It was sort of brought back to life and named in honor of the original Mattachine Society. It's a research group that was founded really to compile this history, which was really, really important, because as we moved into the early 2000s and we started seeing more and more of this legal fight, right, to start fighting against these discriminatory laws, nobody really had a repository for this history, and a lot of it was protected because it was government documents. So the Mattachine Society really prided itself on being sort of the collector of all these important documents. This archival documentation has been used by the Supreme Court when they considered the question of gay marriage. They used it to really illustrate a long-standing policy of discrimination against gay people. It's been used for state lawsuits, so for different legal actions across the country. And it was a fight to get these documents because the government didn't want to just turn over all this evidence that it now had. One of the documents, in fact, that was turned over and used multiple times in court cases was a U.S. Civil Service Commission letter from 1966, which basically uses the wording that the revulsion of other employees at homosexuality is just cause for their termination. So you really see this policy written out in black and white in these government documents. So by filing just Freedom of Information Act petitions over and over and over, they've been able to compile thousands of pages of explicit documentation that shows this discrimination and use it to try to fight against it today. So they have a great website where you can look at some of the documents that have been saved. A lot of these archival documents are starting to find their ways into other archives and collections where they can be preserved, but they have done some really important work in the 21st century in sort of keeping a record of this history.
Awesome. I love that. Yeah. So that's our sort of pre-Stonewall queer history. We will, I'm sure, at some point talk a little bit more
about phase one of queer history in Washington, D.C. I will say for those who come to visit us or when it's safe to visit and come travel, obviously DuPont Circle is a great place to go to really, I think, connect with this era, particularly with Frank Kameny and the Mattagine Society. The National Museum of American History last year, as part of the commemoration of the 50 years since Stonewall, did put in a new exhibit called Illegal to Be You, Gay History Beyond Stonewall. They have a great website that goes along with the exhibit, so you can sort of look at the exhibit virtually, but it has things like a printed pamphlet material from another chapter of the Mattagine Society, not the DC chapter, but one of the LA chapters, I think. They have, you know, some of these protest buttons and materials that were being used.
I heard they had like a bunch of like a dozen or so of Kameny and Ernestine Eckstein's like original signs that they used to protest at the White House. Like that's sort of the centerpiece of the exhibit.
Yeah. So if you're interested in that, you can access it online and get a little bit of a virtual visit. But hopefully by the time you hear this, maybe you can go visit the museum in person. But this history is starting, I think, to get its a little bit more attention the way it should. And I appreciate the Smithsonian for putting that exhibit out. Yes. In the museum.
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, that's what we got.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's really cool. Frank Kameny is a hero. He's super interesting. He also, because he's an astronomer, one of the things they did when he died was name a star or a planet, a small planet after him. There's like a minor planet out there in the cosmos named after Frank Kameny, which I think is just delightful.
I love it. I love this topic. I love the work that you put into it. I love Frank Kameny's story. I love too that it sort of intersects into something we've been talking about a lot too, which is sort of that overlap into the women's movement, because I now want to be like, what about the lesbians? What are the lesbians up to?
Actually, one of the things that funny that you mentioned that, we've been talking a lot about Midge Costanza, who was the first President Carter's special assistant. She was a closeted lesbian at the time. She is going to get her partner, Jane O'Leary, who's part of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, and Frank Kameny in front of President Carter, the first time gay activists have met with the president in March of 1977. So that's actually one of the things that we've been talking about.
That should be when we do phase two, we can talk about the Carter years.
Carter years, yes.
Well, thank you so much for taking us through this. I learned so much in doing this episode, and particularly at everything that you had researched. That was a great episode. If people enjoyed this episode, where can they find more from us, Rebecca?
If you can find more Tour Guide Tell All wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Podbean. You can find us on Twitter at Tour Guide Tell. You can interface with us there, send us questions if you have pod topics or comments about something we've already done, suggestions for future episodes. You can engage with us on Facebook. We're at Free Tours by Foot. And so, yeah, definitely kind of check us out. We have in the show notes, we're going to have links to a bunch of these really interesting topics. Send us questions and comments and future episode ideas, and hit us up on Twitter. We would love to talk to you.
Thank you guys so much for listening.
Thank you.